This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Request for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for September 30th, 2013. The week did not produce a great number of items, but certainly four very interesting ones, beginning with a long opinion coming out of the U.S. Court of Federal Claims denying a STARS transaction, a tax shelter deduction, to BB&T Bank through their subsidiary Salem Financial, and with some really harsh language for all the advisors that were involved. Then we have, as we expected, guidance on the application of the Windsor decision holding that Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. In Notice 2013-61, the IRS gives us some guidance for employers and employees to claim refunds of taxes erroneously paid in open years. And then I picked up an article coming out of the American Bar Association meeting on that has to do with partnerships and the allocation of debt to partners for determining basis. And then a very clear opinion coming out of the tax court in a summary opinion in Jennifer White that you don't have to have the Form 8832 in order to claim status as custodial parent and claim your children as dependents. In any event, that's what we have to work on, so let's get started. Salem Financial is your citation on this one. The Court of Federal Claims held that a structured trust advantaged repackaged securities, that's a STARS, foreign tax credit generator transaction engaged in by BB&T lacked economic substance, and the court hit them with $112 million of accuracy-related penalties. I want to read some excerpts from Judge Thomas Wheeler's opinion that I think you'll find enlightening. First, the amount at issue, including the potential assessment of taxpayers' penalties, is $772,144,153.45. The judge is being very precise. The amount is composed of the following: disallowed foreign tax credits, $500 million, disallowed interest, $74 million, tax on what were called BX payments from Barclays to BB&T to try to construct some sort of business purpose, $84 million, disallowed transaction costs, $2.6 million, and finally penalties of $112 million. Now, how did all this happen? Well, BB&T had what the judge referred to as an insatiable appetite for tax reduction, and whether they seduced their advisors or the advisors seduced BB&T, they managed to get themselves in a fine mess. The main question presented, according to the judge, is whether the STARS transaction had any purpose other than to generate tax savings, and if not, whether penalties should be assessed against the bank. There are different ways of looking at the STARS transaction, according to Judge Wheeler, and the court has wrestled with the question of how best to analyze the transaction. The STARS trust component, where BB&T revenue momentarily is cycled through a UK trustee to create UK taxes and foreign tax credits and then is returned to BB&T, quite clearly is an abusive tax avoidance scheme. So the transaction rests on an abusive tax avoidance scheme. The scheme created a series of instantaneous circular cash flows starting and ending with BB&T. It came back to the bank that they started from, where no economic activity has occurred abroad to justify the assessment of a UK tax. So the court then goes on to consider whether a $1.5 billion loan from Barclays Bank, another participant in this scheme, to BB&T at favorable interest rates somehow provides the necessary economic substance, and the court deconstructed the way that loan worked and the way other payments worked. So one stream of payments offset the other stream of payments, except that they weren't immediately recognizable as connected. But here's the clincher. The conduct of those persons from BB&T, Barclays, KPMG, and the Sidley Austin law firm who were involved in this and other transactions was nothing short of reprehensible. The professionals involved should have known better than to follow the STARS path, rife with its conflicts of interest, questionable pro forma legal and accounting opinions, and a taxpayer with a seemingly insatiable appetite for tax avoidance. Reprehensible is a strong word. I would not want to be on the receiving end of that one. The day after the court announced this opinion, the Department of Justice was trumpeting its victory. Today's ruling sends a strong message, according to Assistant Attorney General Catherine Kennelly, that no matter how sophisticated the scheme, these sham tax shelters will not stand. Next, we have Notice 2013-61. Following up on the Supreme Court's decision in Windsor that Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, and IRS Revenue Ruling 2013-17, that same-sex couples legally married in jurisdictions that recognize their marriages will be treated as married for federal tax purposes regardless of whether the couple lives in a jurisdiction that recognizes same-sex marriage. This is the so-called State of Celebration Rule. The holdings in Revenue Ruling 2013-17, according to Notice 2013-61, apply prospectively as of September 16, 2013. However, the notice points out that taxpayers may retroactively apply the holdings for some purposes, and one of those purposes is, for example, if one spouse of a same-sex married couple owns a business and the other spouse works for that person, they've been forced to withhold and match FICA. But spouses are not subject to FICA when they are employed by the other spouse. So those self-employed spouses will be filing refund claims. Similarly, some employers provided benefits to same-sex spouses, but those benefits were taxable to the employee. And now both the employer and the employee can file claims for refund. The question is, how do we do that? And the IRS is making that easy. That's the substance of Notice 2013-61, and here's how that's going to be accomplished. For 2013, the notice provides two alternative special administrative procedures. Under the first alternative, employers may use the fourth quarter 2013 Form 941 to correct those overpayments of employment taxes for the first three quarters of 2013. Under the second alternative, employers may use one Form 941X to adjust all four quarters of 2013. With respect to overpayments of FICA for years before 2013, employers should make a claim for adjustment for all four calendar quarters on one Form 941X filed for the fourth quarter of each year. Now, those special administrative procedures are optional. Employers that prefer to use the regular procedures can do so. But this gives employers who have withheld taxes on benefits provided to employees, and it gives self-employed spouses who have employed their other same-sex spouse a chance to recover FICA taxes in particular that, according to the Supreme Court's decision in Windsor, should never have been collected. Next, I want to report, and this is just one article of many that have been swirling around the past few weeks. The concern here is with the anticipated proposed Section 752 partnership debt allocation rules. And what is expected is that the IRS is going to include in those rules a net worth maintenance requirement so that partners will not be able to construct entities that get basis for losses where the entity has no net worth and, in fact, there is no economic risk. So the whole issue here is making sure that there is true economic risk for a partner who indemnifies or guarantees partnership debt. Beverly Katz, Special Counsel, IRS Office of Associate Chief Counsel, in her remarks, says that we're probably going to require that there be certain terms like maintaining your net worth or perhaps even providing financial statements when requested. There will be testing events in terms of when you determine whether you have sufficient net worth, just like, and this is an interesting just like, the Regulation Section 1.752-2K rules. Now, there's been a great deal of controversy about whether simply guaranteeing partnership debt provides the partner with basis to claim losses. And the answer, of course, is that if the partner has no capability of fulfilling the guarantee, or if the liability on the guarantee is so remote, well, those are called bottom dollar guarantees, if there are so many other people in front of you that you would never be called on to perform on the guarantee, should you in fact get basis for losses from such a guarantee? And of course, most of us would answer reasonably no, but maybe we'd be tempted on behalf of our clients to try to construct some sort of a deal where we got basis by simply signing a piece of paper without any true economic risk. And that's what the IRS is after. And they're probably going to have some sort of net worth representation requirement in these regulations, new 752 regulations, when they finally come out. Now, finally this week, we have Jennifer White, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2013-77. Jennifer White and her husband were divorced after several years of marriage, and his name is Sutherland. During their divorce proceedings, Ms. White and Mr. Sutherland filed a separation agreement in Georgia, which handled their divorce. The parties agreed to joint legal custody of two children, and that Mr. Sutherland would be the open quote custodial parent, close quote. So apparently, the separation agreement made Mr. Sutherland the custodial parent. Separation agreement went on to outline their visitation rights, the specific holidays, weekends, etc., and that was back in 1997. By 2010, both children are living with their mother, and Ms. White claimed them as dependents. She claimed head of household status. She claimed the child tax credit and as the custodial parent. But can she be the custodial parent if that separation agreement designated her former husband as the custodial parent? Well, here's what the judge has to say. In the case of divorced parents, special rules determine which parent is entitled to a dependency exemption deduction for a child. Generally, a child who is in the custody of one or both of the child's parents for more than one half of the calendar year and receives more than one half of his or her support from parents who live apart at all times during the last 6 months of the calendar year will be considered the qualifying child, and that qualifying child term is important, remember, of the custodial parent. Pursuant to Section 152E, a child may be treated as a qualifying child of the non-custodial parent rather than of the custodial parent when certain criteria are met. And the judge goes on to examine the purpose of a Form 8332. Now, was it necessary for Ms. White to get a Form 8332 from her former husband, Mr. Sutherland? The answer is no. Why? Well, the provisions of Section 152E identify circumstances where the non-custodial parent may claim a child. Pursuant to Section 152E4A and B, the term custodial parent doesn't mean the person named in the separation agreement. It means the parent having custody for the greater portion of the calendar year. And the term non-custodial parent means the parent who's not the custodial parent. In the regulation, Section 1.152-4D defines custody as follows. The custodial parent is the parent with whom the child resides for the greater number of nights during the calendar year, and the non-custodial parent is the parent who is not the custodial parent. So Ms. White did not need a Form 8853 in order to claim her children as dependents because she met the statutory qualification as a custodial parent. That's really important to remember because I think a lot of folks miss that point in the statute. Yes, if it isn't clear where the child lived, or if the child in fact lived with the person who's designated as the custodial parent, in order for the custodial parent to give the right to claim the dependency exemption to the non-custodial parent, you got to have the form. But if the kids are with you more than one half of the nights of the year, you don't need a form and you're qualifying children, and you're the head of household, you claim as a dependent, and you claim the child tax credits and all the other benefits that go along with being a parent. Well, as I warned you, this is a short program this week. Thank you so much for joining me, and remember, stay safe.